You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I would like to welcome everybody to the Open Society Foundation's New York office. My name is Cornelius Graupner. I'm with the Central Eurasia Project. Well, thanks for coming here. We have an excellent panel here today talking about how autocratic regimes undermine democratic institutions in the West. Our panel consists of Khadija Ismailova, Ken Silverstein, Lincoln Mitchell, who will moderate the event, and Gerald Knaus. With this, I'll hand over to Lincoln.
Thank you for putting this event together, Cornelius and everyone at OSI, and thank you for inviting me to moderate it. I'm going to make some brief comments. I'm not going to introduce the speakers because you have or can access biographical information if you want it, except for that as I was cycling over here, it occurred to me that this topic is something that's been interesting to me for a while, so I'm very happy to be here. But also, if you created a computer program, I want to just step back for a moment and think about it from the angle of people and voters in places like the United States and Europe who maybe don't think about foreign policy a lot. But if you created a computer program to figure out what would get them the most angry about how American foreign policy is made, you might have an element of dirty money coming in and influence. You might have an element of lobbyists, which they hate. You might have an element of people actually receiving money from the United States to lobby the United States more, which would also get them crazy. You would get pretty much what we have now. And this strikes me as an interesting way to think about it and to explore it. It's implicitly, there's not a lot of attention paid to these questions, paid to how non-democratic regimes seek to change how they're perceived, seeks to change how the discussions around democracy issues occur. We spent a lot of time in the U.S. discussing, you know, ethnic lobbying, diaspora politics. This is something really qualitatively different. And I also just want to flag that, you know, it is while it is easy to look at the activities of a country like Azerbaijan or Turkmenistan and say, you know, there's a real problem here, we also have to recognize that because of the role the U.S. has taken for itself, the role that Europeans take for themselves as the judges of what's democratic and what's not, that what matters, what our Congress says, what European legislatures say, matters a lot. And there is really basically really one way to influence it. So I think there's some complexity here, and I hope we will have a good discussion. Our first speaker is going to be Gerald, followed by Ken, and then Khadija. Gerald.
Thanks a lot, and thanks also to OSI and to Cornelius in particular for this opportunity to speak here. What I will do, representing a think tank that has been working the last 15 years in the Balkans, Turkey, and the South Caucasus, from a European perspective, is talk about something that you will find in this little report, Caviar Diplomacy, how Azerbaijan silenced the Council of Europe, which we put out a few weeks ago, which is a quite amazing story, case study of how one particular authoritarian regime has been silencing, capturing, manipulating, if you want, the most respected human rights intergovernmental organization in Europe. Certainly the oldest, perhaps no longer the most respected, but it could become the most respected again, we hope, and do what it is supposed to do, namely ensure that human rights and democratic standards are safeguarded across an area of 47 member states and 800 million European citizens. Now, this is a story of Azerbaijan, of that institution, the Council of Europe, and of its failures in the last few years, but also of some possible remedies. But I think the implications go beyond this particular country and this particular institution. Now, the first point perhaps to make is why Azerbaijan, why it matters. Well, it's a small country, 8 million people on the Caspian. It is oil and gas rich and has had phenomenal growth rates in the last few years, based essentially on its exports of raw materials. It is also a state that, since its independence from the Soviet Union in the early 90s, has not had a single set of elections that outside observers have considered free and fair. And yet, Azerbaijan joined the Council of Europe in the year 2000, in January. Now, why the Council of Europe? The Council of Europe is Europe's oldest club of democracies. Václav Havel, the former dissident and then president of Czechoslovakia, once flattered it as the most important European institution for democratic values.
because it is actually at its core committed to safeguard the European Convention on Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms. It sits in Strasbourg on the border of France and Germany. It has a court that is well known, the European Court of Human Rights, which can issue binding judgments and condemn states like Russia to pay damages to citizens that are found that their rights were violated. And it also has an assembly of parliamentarians of all the member states. Otherwise, it has very little in the way of power. What it can do is it can issue reports, it has rapporteurs who do monitoring, it can discuss these reports, and in the parliamentary assembly, it can decide that some members who want to sit there, let's say from Azerbaijan, who've been elected, have not been elected democratically, so they lose their right to vote, or one step further, they lose their right to sit there. There is a secretariat as well. The general secretary is currently a former Norwegian foreign minister who's also on the Nobel Peace Prize Committee. Now, this is the setup. Azerbaijan joined in 2000 while everybody knew that it did not fulfill the conditions of the Council of Europe being a democracy. In the past, when countries were not democratic, like Greece when it had its military coup, or Turkey when it had its military coups, found themselves under enormous pressure. Greece even withdrew from the Council of Europe. So the theory is that you have to be a democracy. Now, Azerbaijan joined. Everybody knew it was not yet a democracy, and yet the assumption was that it would develop into one. You bring the country in, and then the rules of the club and its instruments will shame the elites into complying with basic standards. The problem was that this only worked for a few years. It did work for a few years. In the first few years, there were monitors, a Swiss member of the parliamentary assembly, a member of the Swiss parliament who would regularly visit Azerbaijan, who would issue harrowing reports about the human rights situation, who would be vilified in the local media, but who would in the end manage to get some political prisoners released. There would be debates on elections, and in early 2006, there would even be the motion after a completely fraudulent election in 2005 to withdraw the voting rights. Now, these debates have one big disadvantage. Very few people in Europe follow them. There are very few journalists in Strasbourg. There are no think tanks who really work on this. I admit, as a think tank person who's been working on European issues for 15 years, I've never really read a paper on the Council of Europe that I found interesting until recently. Because think tankers just don't work on Strasbourg very much. You know the court, but the rest, you don't think it matters. But Azerbaijan realized it does matter. And this is, I think, the major argument that it matters, because Azerbaijan realized, the regime, that the legitimacy that comes from being in that club and having that club confirm that you are democracy and having European parliamentarians travel to Azerbaijan and be on television the day after elections saying that these elections are more or less in line with standards is enormously valuable, certainly to the regime. So when, after 5 years of criticism, the Azerbaijani government decided enough was enough, we don't want to be put on the spot anymore, it decided to pursue what has become a very systematic campaign of capturing the institution. Now, how do you do that? Well, we had a number of insiders giving us detailed insights into how this worked, but we also studied, and this is all in this report, in detail how one institution after the other were captured. Now, first, you identify your friends. In the case of Azerbaijan, they can count on the votes of the Russians when it comes to human rights, the Turks, mostly the Georgians, the Ukrainians, countries that have geopolitical interests in the regime liking them. Then they started looking at the Balkans, countries like Serbia, which, of course, today has a 3-meter-high statue in the Central Park in Belgrade, financed by the Azerbaijani government, and a special meeting room in the Foreign Ministry of Serbia, which I saw recently walking past by accident with a big plaque, Azerbaijan Room, in two languages. Countries that have oil interests in the Balkans, other small countries that you don't normally pay so much attention to. Now, all of this gives you some votes, but then you also want to have supporters of West European countries. So you cultivate friends in the UK, in Germany, in Spain, in Italy. You organize a whole series of events and conferences, the Baku Humanitarian Forum, a big event on democracy in Azerbaijan. You invite your friends, sometimes 5 or 6 times a year, some of your special friends. And as we wrote in our report, you regularly make them gifts. You give them caviar, which is not so worthless as it might seem. It's not just a little gift. A caviar, a kilo, can be more than $1,000 worth. And if you have four sessions a year in Strasbourg and you regularly give people caviar, your friends, you know, this adds up to something. You give carpets, you give jewelry, you pay people on occasion. Now, all of this generates compliance, which was very visible in the last few years. And I can give you a few examples where the Council of Europe basically stopped being critical. Now, there are a few ways in which this then works. You mobilize people, your friends, to turn up at votes. So when Azerbaijan was supposed to be censored in early 2006, it turned out that a record number of people were present in the assembly, more than ever, because of a debate on Azerbaijan, which is bizarre. There were more people in this vote on the censoring of Azerbaijan than were when it was the decision whether Azerbaijan should join or not. It was one of the record attendances, and this attendance ensured that while 67 people wanted to withdraw the voting rights, actually 100 voted against. Now, this is one way in which you work. It's legitimate. It's normal politics. Less legitimate is when you work on election observation missions. Now, the scandalous story of the elections 2010 actually revealing some general lessons for this region. In 2010, you had long-term election observation mission from the ODIHR, the OSCE, in the country for 2 months, identifying that these elections were fraudulent. For example, finding out that of the major opposition bloc, 88 candidates, 50 were blocked from even standing. So the elections were decided 2 weeks before the elections because the opposition could only contest 38 of 125 seats. In addition, you had 11% of the votes that were observed were fraudulent. 33% of the counting was fraudulent. You know, it was a very clear picture, well described by long-term observers, international from the ODIHR, the OSCE Democratization Mission. But what it turned out at the end was that the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, which also observed the same elections, run by a Belgian senator and his Polish deputy, decided that these elections met all Council of Europe standards and said so in the media, even before the voting booths were closed, and repeated it in the Parliamentary Assembly in Strasbourg. Now, this was worth a lot in terms of prestige for the government, because it meant the Council of Europe in 2010 did not actually have a debate whether this completely fraudulent election should lead to Azerbaijan and the delegates elected in those elections losing their voting rights. Now, what can one do? I close with this. What one can do is increase attention, increase interest, because what we realized is that it is, in fact, the lack of attention paid to these debates in those institutions, which makes it possible for some members of these parliamentary assemblies to get away with such things, but also reduces the incentives for others to make their name fighting those things. We found that quite a lot of Europeans from across old established democracies usually didn't bother to hang around for some of those key votes, because Azerbaijan, you know, they're cynical, they don't believe anything can change. But when you tell the stories of young dissidents in Azerbaijan, you know, courageous people who, in the mode of the dissidents of the 70s or 80s in communist Czechoslovakia, are standing up for things. And when you then say, look, these dissidents are being betrayed, when they see on television, you know, a Belgian liberal senator praise elections which are obviously fraudulent, one dissident saw that being in prison, having been forced to hand in a ballot which had already been filled out in 2010, and then he saw this Belgian senator praise the elections. Now, you're betraying your core duty. In addition, you're undermining the standards that apply to the rest of Europe. You know, if we are worried about standards of democracy in other European democracies, if Azerbaijan sets the standards for everybody, if the elections of 2010 or the record on freedom of the media of Azerbaijan is good enough for the Council of Europe, then really, we don't need it. So what we are trying to argue, and this is the core of our current campaign, and this week was a small success for Azerbaijani dissidents and their friends abroad, when a report on human rights and political prisoners in Azerbaijan by a Council of Europe rapporteur who for three years did not even get a visa to travel to Azerbaijan. And the regime got away with this. Nobody officially from the institutions complained. Decided to write a report anyways and put it in the Committee on Human Rights, a legal committee in Strasbourg, and got it approved with a vote of 25 to 23 votes. Now, the 23 who voted against, you know, were obviously surprised that so many of the other side turned up. They will try again in October. What we are trying to do is create interest using NGOs, using the media, making the people who vote on these small countries that otherwise, you know, are not paid attention to, that they realize that there is a price to pay or a reward to get
for standing up for democracy.
I think a lot of these are issues that affect other countries. The crisis of election observation missions, there are structural problems. The crisis of monitoring and the success of lobbyists. All of this also applies elsewhere, and I leave with that.
Thank you.
I'm going to talk about a piece I did a few years ago for Harper's Magazine. And in it, I posed as a businessman who had interest in Turkmenistan. And I approached a number of top Washington lobbying firms and asked them to make the government of Turkmenistan look better. But the fact is that this story could have been written about any number of countries. I mean, it could have been written about Azerbaijan or Kazakhstan or Equatorial Guinea or Chad or any number of oil or energy-rich countries that spend a lot of money to polish their image in Washington. So while I'm going to focus a little bit, or at least the subtext is Turkmenistan, it really applies to any of these countries because they all have big, big budgets for Washington lobbying. So what I did was I claimed in approaching these lobbyists that I worked for a Lebanese businessman who had a company called the Malden Group, which was named, I found the name, it's a British salt company. And so I picked the Malden Group, and we picked a phony, when I was working with people at Harper's, we picked a phony address in London. And we made up business cards, and we created a website that had nothing but the homepage for the phony Malden Group, and the phone number, which was my British cell phone number. I had bought a British cell phone so that I could, you know, call Washington lobbyists, and it looked like I was calling from London, and they could call me, and it looked like they were calling me in London, even though I was sitting on the second floor of my home working on my computer. So I told them that I worked for this. I knew I couldn't pass, of course, as Turkmen or British, so I said I was an American who worked for this British businessman. The Malden Group had a significant stake in Turkmen gas fields, and that in order to enhance our stake and position in Turkmenistan, we were going to hire a Washington lobbying firm so that the government would be very happy with us. And with this very, very flimsy cover story, really, I mean, the website was registered to somewhere in Pennsylvania, I approached these firms and I asked them, well, would you be willing to work for me? You know, Turkmenistan, of course, is controversial. I'm sure some of you are familiar with the great Turkmenbashi, as he called himself, who had died. I mean, this is why, in fact, we picked Turkmenistan in part, was that the Turkmenbashi, the old dictator, who had built statues of himself all over Ashgabat, including one that revolved to face, so that his face was always facing the sun. He had just died, and so that, you know, we had this great cover story, which is, you know, there's a new president, you know, things are changing in Turkmenistan, and this is the moment where we need to approach the American public and policymakers and let them know about the exciting new things happening. Now, we, of course, did not want to harp on little things like that the new president had won an election in which all opposition parties were banned, and he won something like 99% of the vote, one of those, you know, 99% or close, that he was the former dentist to the Turkmenbashi, that he was the health minister who had completely destroyed the Turkmen healthcare system. So these were little things that we didn't want the lobbyists to highlight. We just wanted to look at, you know, the emerging democracy in Turkmenistan with this new wise leader. So, I also told them that, and by the way, they'd say, well, tell me more about the Malden Group. And I said, I can't. I just won't do that. I mean, it's a small company. We're very private. Discretion is the very lifeblood of our operation. And, you know, if you want to know more about the Malden Group, I'm terribly sorry. I can go to other lobbying firms. And they all caved completely and said, no, that's fine. Actually, two of the four said, well, we would really like some more information. I approached four firms. So anyway, the two that were nosy, we just dropped, a little bit nosy. They were willing to work for the Malden Group, but they wanted a little bit more information. So I went to APCO, which had previously represented Sani Abacha in Nigeria, and they had done some work, I believe, for Azerbaijan as well. and Cassidy and Associates, which had represented Equatorial Guinea, and some, well, probably too much detail, a few other controversial regimes. I mean, and Cassidy, in fact, told me that when they talked to me about, I'd say, well, what can you do? How are you going to, beyond the specifics of your lobbying operation, tell me about your achievements for some of your past clients. And Cassidy actually said to me, well, for years, President Obiang of Equatorial Guinea was on Parade Magazine's top 10 list of the world's worst dictators, and we got him off that list. So it's like, that was a great achievement. So I actually then went home and did a Google search, and they did. He was off the top 10. They had gotten him to number 11. So this was their great, for $1.5 million a year, that's what they had done. So I said to them, okay, what can you do for us? How are you going to make this, Turkmenistan look better? And they both the firms had a very similar program, although I'll get to cost. I mean, the cost was quite a range there. So they said, we will bring Turkmen officials over here. We have connections all over town, so we'll get them meetings with Congress and with administration officials and with State Department officials. And then we'll take congressional staffers over to Turkmenistan. First, we'll start with staffers, and then we'll get real members of Congress to go over there. And this was not long after the Abramoff scandal. I'm sure many of you are familiar with Jack Abramoff, the lobbyist who went to jail for some of the work he did. And the APCO actually said to me, I'm paraphrasing, but basically they said, technically that's not legal. We can't actually pay for a trip. So what we'll do is we'll find a Turkmen university or a think tank, and we'll get them to sponsor the trip. And then through the back door, we'll pay for the trip because we're not allowed to pay for it directly. So they said they organized these fact-finding missions over there. They both talked about putting op-eds in American newspapers. APCO specifically said they had someone on staff whose sole job was to write opinion pieces, then go out and recruit academics or think tanks people to put their name on it, and then this person placed the op-eds in newspapers around the country. They said they could not do this in the New York Times or the really first tier, but that they could place pieces in second tier papers like the Houston Chronicle or the Seattle Times, and so that they would be able to get these opinion pieces out there, and that they would also work with journalists who they were friendly with in order to shape opinion. They also talked about organizing think tank events in Washington. They said, in fact, one of the lobbyists I spoke to had formerly been with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and they said that they would work with think tanks and they could set up events that would appear to be independent, but in which they, and through them, the Malden Group, would control the agenda and really select the speakers. And APCO actually said to me, we don't want to organize an event called Turkmenistan Day because that would be too obvious. So we'll call it something like Caspian Sea Pipeline Day, or something like that. And we won't have all the speakers. Won't be talking about Turkmenistan. We'll throw in somebody to talk about something else. But basically, we'll control the event and we'll shape it. And they also, organized similar events with The Economist and Roll Call, which is a small publication in Washington, but works covers Capitol Hill real intensely. And they both, for a fee, The Economist, which surprised me, the Economist banner will hang in the background, or the Roll Call banner will hang in the background. So it looks like, they're sponsoring it, but somebody else is paying for the event. And they talked about how they... it would probably be a mistake to focus too much on human rights and these sorts of issues because, there were limits to what they could do on that front. And, and they both said that, and by the way, this is going to cost you more if something bad happens over there. I mean, they didn't say, if the government were to mow down hundreds of unarmed demonstrators, but they suggested that if something unfortunate along those lines took place, that my fee would be jacked up. So we're not going to focus on human rights. We're going to talk about energy security because that really is a winner, And we can get away with that one. And in terms of cost, APCO said, I think APCO said it was $400,000 per year plus expenses. And Cassidy said to me, you know, look, this is a tough case, and, you know, 1 year is just not going to work. So we're going to propose a 3-year plan, $1.5 million a year over 3 years plus expenses. So it was $5 million plus to make the, you know, former the Turkmenbashi's former dentist look like Turkmenistan's George Washington. So, and during questions, I can, if there are questions, I can tell you more about some of the things they propose doing.
Thank you.
I actually have, similar stories about Azerbaijan. And Chancellor Stern was talking, I was just thinking about how the systems work similarly and how alike are the systems. So no matter where in the layers of democracy your country is, but the dictators think alike. So this is one of the findings. But I want to talk about Azerbaijani perspective of how Azerbaijan portrays itself in world scene and how they manage to convince the other countries in their democratic aspirations. I'm talking about the government of Azerbaijan. One of the latest examples, Hillary Clinton visited Baku a couple weeks ago, and she met in Azerbaijan with the government officials and with civil society, they said. Well, I saw the list of the people whom she met, and I didn't find, and it was the meeting with civil society, as was announced, was the meeting with civil society representatives who are within the part of the Open Government Partnership Initiative. This is the transparency initiative started by the US and Brazil, and Azerbaijan has joined the initiative in September 2011. So Minister of Foreign Affairs wrote a letter saying that Azerbaijan is a long-term participant of the extractive industry transparency initiative, and Azerbaijan is keen to be part of the open government partnership initiative. Well, the list of the civil society activists whom Hillary Clinton met was strange. I didn't see a single name who would openly speak about corruption, high-level corruption in Azerbaijan. There were, the names of the organizations were, gross. They, you see Transparency Azerbaijan, you see, very good, very good names of organization there, but you never heard them speaking about high-level corruption in Azerbaijan. By speaking of high-level corruption, I mean the corruption where president and ministers are involved. Media made several, I did several investigative reports, which disclosed president's family direct interest in corruption models in Azerbaijan. We disclosed the gold contract where president's daughters have 11% stake in Azerbaijan. We revealed that president's daughters own 9 offshore companies in Panama through which they own businesses in a different kind of businesses in Azerbaijan. Almost half of the banking sector in Azerbaijan is registered in the same apartment where, according to the voters list, president's wife and 2 daughters were registered till recently. So this is the kind of corruption that actually, again, I'm not chasing that family. It's just wherever you dig, you find this family name. And And it's strange that these anti-corruption activists have never made any statement about this level of corruption in Azerbaijan. So these are the people State Secretary chose to meet in Azerbaijan. Well, then she met President. They had talk on different issues. And according to officials of the presidential administration, they had positive positive feedback almost on everything. There was also some talk about journalists who's been attacked. Well, we didn't hear much from embassy or Hillary Clinton herself on how strongly she stood for the human rights cases in Azerbaijan. We didn't hear it from them. From the official of presidential administration, we first heard that there was a laughter when they've been discussing one human rights case, the beating of journalist Idrak Abbasov. And then Hillary Clinton was happy with the government's position regarding case that involves me, which is I was blackmailed with a sex tape. And there was a camera in my bedroom, bathroom and living room, and they've been filming me for a while, and then the video was, first I was blackmailed, and then the video was posted online. And Hillary Clinton said she's happy with the government's position. That's what presidential administration guy said to us. He was speaking from, it was TV interview, nobody put anything to his mouth. He gave this information. Well, the latest position of the government was that I shouldn't have complained about interference into my privacy because I interfered president's privacy by investigating his family business. Well, I don't know how, I don't know if Hillary Clinton knew about that position because that was a position voiced by the presidential administration official in the public event and repeated several times by different officials. And the person is also representative of the government of Azerbaijan in the European Court of Human Rights. He's a lawyer, by the way. And so I don't know if Hillary Clinton knew about that position, but she definitely found something to welcome in government's position regarding my case. Well, I'm still trying to convince investigation to investigate the case regarding interference to my privacy. And there is, of course, no investigation of the businesses of president's family, despite the fact that all documents has been displayed and actually corruption fact is more than obvious. But what we have on media is Azerbaijan is a part of Open Government Partnership Initiative, and Azerbaijan is a part of Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative. Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative is something that was initiated by Tony Blair, and actually the idea came from George Soros, I guess, before that. The companies publish, oil companies publish what they pay to the government, government publishes what they received from the oil companies, and that's it. Transparency is done. But that's not. We don't know who are the partners of Azerbaijani government, the state oil company, in number of joint ventures, because those are offshore companies linked to, going through Switzerland, Malta, United Arab Emirates, different offshore countries. So we don't know who are behind those companies. We don't know who is selling the oil for Azerbaijani government, for state oil company of Azerbaijan. It's huge money. It's billions every year, and we have no idea who are those people, and why. There were no tenders to establish those partners. So this is the reality we have, we are living in Azerbaijan. But for the rest of the world, Azerbaijan is a member of Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative because Azerbaijan signed for. And Azerbaijan is a part of the Open Government Partnership. So this is about oil money. But there are people who investigate things. These are journalists. How much? How many? Okay. Journalists, NGOs who champion for transparency. These are investigators, activists, youth activists. And they are being arrested, beaten, kidnapped, silenced. And one journalist had been killed in 2005. Another journalist had been killed in 2011. So this is the another part of it. So there is an effort by the government to silence all these people. For that purposes, they establish a NGO support fund, which actually deals with bribing NGOs. Media support fund, which actually bribes media organizations. They have NGOs, we call them gongos. It's government-organized NGO. They establish gongos to justify election falsifications, gongos to ask president to give apartments to journalists. And then announces president a friend of media, despite the fact that there are seven journalists in the prison. So this is the reality we have. And then we have cases which Gerald told about, like cases about silencing people outside the country. So what do we have? We have very good PR machine working outside and inside the country against the truth, basically. And those who are still willing to expose that truth, they are in danger. And they are not even supported by the democratic institutions from outside in a full extent. And this is, again, one of the results of the government's policy. For example, National Democratic Institute and Human Rights House has been closed in Azerbaijan. The police came and sealed their offices. Then police came and unsealed National Democratic Institute's office. And now National NDI is giving a grant to organization which is called Azerbaijani Youth Integration to Europe, Organization for Azerbaijani Youth Integration to Europe. And that the head of that organization publicly admitted in an interview that she takes her members to the state TV to act for public opinion polls. Like they write Baku residents condemn opposition. And the members of this organization play their normal citizens, like as if it was Vox Pop shot in the street of Baku. But they organize it, like this organization provides Vox Pop. So this organization got $60,000 from NDI after new opening to promote youth activism in one of the districts. So this is one case. And I will talk about another cases if you will have more questions, because I don't have time now.
Thank you for the panel. And it's always fun being the only thing funner than having to cut everyone off is being speaking right before the cocktail hour. So if you have questions, line up in the middle. Please be sure to say your name and some kind of identifying, or affiliation. Please keep the questions brief so that we can get through as many people as possible. And I'm going to start by just making some observations, to which I don't want you to react now, maybe to kind of just think about. One is, in hearing this, I'm a little reminded of going to hear Mearsheimer and Walt give a talk where they expressed complete outrage at the fact that, American citizens tried to lobby their government, you know? And what was striking in their talk was how what they needed was a good course in American politics to understand that, you know, this is how the system works, right? And a lot of what we're hearing today, I mean, this is probably a condemnation of the system, but this is also how domestic politics work, right? If you're making cigarettes and you want to maybe think, you can go to those same firms and they'll say, hey, for $1 million, we'll tell you what museum art exhibit to sponsor, right? Or something like that. So this is not a new thing. This is a kind of migration of a dysfunctional policy, in my view, dysfunctional policy setup to international arenas where it may be, in fact, more nefarious for a whole range of reasons. But I just want to highlight that this is kind of how Washington's works. The next and whatever side you're on, if you don't employ those means, you're not going to get anything done in Washington. So if you're actually fighting the good fight, you need access to those means too. The second one that always puzzles me is, why does it work this way? These legislatures, whether they're in Strasbourg or in Washington, they know they're being spun, right? The Houston Chronicle or the Detroit Free Press, they know who's calling them with this op-ed, but the system still works, and that always strikes me as interesting. It's also, this to me is very illustrative of how the new technology, which was supposed to set us all free, is not only setting us all free, right? It's also creating a lot of problems. Many of these governments have people whose job it is to upload things to Facebook all day long, or to make sure the right tweets are going out from the right people, and that's part of what frames all of this. If these firms that you spoke to were smart, they would say, we have a very good social networking sector, and we'll be doing Facebook and Twitter and all of that, too. Anyway, so that's my comments, but I don't want to respond to right away. Maybe just come up and we can start the questions and answers. So maybe let's do like two or so at a time, and then you can talk and respond.
My name's Judy. I worked as an analyst for the government for almost 7 years, and our government.
Which government?
The U.S. government.
Which? The U.S.
Sorry. I'm from New York. I recently moved back. I've been duped for all the... I'm mind-boggled of all the lectures I've been to all the years I was living there and who was sponsoring it. I just wanted to ask you generally what happened after your article was printed. Were you in danger? That's what my question.
Hello, thank you for this wonderful panel. My name is Natalia Costas, and I work for an international NGO that deals with women's rights issues, International Alliance of Women. And I had a question because I had a pleasure of working on a regional project in South Caucasus, and a number of institutions in European institutions in the European Union, as well as the U.S., support kind of regional initiatives and strengthening the South Caucasus region, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, as ways of, I think, strengthening the democratic institutions there. And does this approach really work, and what are some problems with it, and what do you think about it?
I can respond certainly to the first one, since that was specifically about the article. What happened after the piece came out was, in the short term, it created a big stink, and the lobbyists were, needless to say, quite upset. And it generated a big debate within journalism circles and a little bit beyond. And what the lobbyists tried to do was to say that they couldn't really say that, you know, they sort of initially tried to say, well, he took things out of context, but I mean, I had emails from them, and I had PowerPoints where they laid out exactly what they were going to do. So they couldn't really get far with that. So the general line of attack was that, he went undercover, and what he did was totally dishonest, and hence the entire piece should be discredited, which got some traction among certain quarters of the Washington Press Corps, led by Howard Kurtz, who was then at Washington Post and now at Newsweek. But what I found was that, you know, this to me is reflective of the whole bubble of Washington, because you have, in Washington, people do things that are fundamentally just wrong. Evil, some might be going too far in some cases, but that are fundamentally wrong, and that if you don't live in Washington, you understand instantly that they're wrong. You know, in Washington, you can go to a cocktail party And, like, what do you do? Oh, well, I lobby for, you know, the government of Turkmenistan and, you know, or this or that dictator. And people are like, oh, yeah, that's interesting. Well, I work for, you know, Procter & Gamble. You know, but if you do that in Iowa or Nebraska, people might just say, well, get the hell out of my house. I mean, you know, like, it's what's normal in Washington is not really normal in other parts of the country. And so that argument got some traction in the Washington Press Corps, but, you know, when I mean, I've been writing pieces for 25 years. There was no article I've ever written that generated more outrage than that piece, where people were, you know, I mean, I get hundreds, maybe more than 1,000 emails, congratulatory emails, you know, from people around the country saying, that was great, you know, don't let them, you know, don't get down by the attacks on you because what you did was amazing. I mean, my favorite email of all time probably came from someone who said, you know, whatever happens the rest of your life, whenever you die, like, that's enough. Like, that article is enough. So, you know, the reaction from normal people outside of Washington was, it was great. Now, it being Washington, the reaction or the impact was almost nil. It was nothing. Because Washington, you know, in my view, and, you know, I have an overly cynical view of the world in general, but in my view, politics is done. I mean, Washington is captured. The city over the last 30 years has become captured by money. I mean, the country is fundamentally undemocratic. And we are in a situation where, you know, the going to the polls to vote is a nice little exercise to do every 4 years, but fundamentally the system has been hollowed out and people with money run the government. And so, you know, you had a reaction of outrage and then nothing. Because lobbying is so deeply ingrained in the system that, you know, you just can't change. I mean, lobbyists raise all the campaign money. I mean, politicians are completely dependent on the cash that they raise. It's an institution. It's like, you know, the judiciary. I mean, lobbyists are a fourth branch of government. And so, you know, for a few weeks, lobbyists were embarrassed. And then they started working for the same crummy clients. And so, excuse me? And probably attracted additional ones. That's right. I mean, I actually had a guy who wrote a lobbyist who was outraged about it and who said that, you know, he just felt like I'm digressing a little, but he talked a little, he said that, you know, he would happily represent the worst clients because every person is entitled to self-defense. This is what lobbyists say a lot, is that, you know, it's just like a defense attorney. It's like, no, it's not like a defense attorney at all. Because everyone is entitled, if you're going to prison, you have a right to an attorney. If you're a dictator that is killing your own people and stealing the treasury, you don't have the right to a public relations firm. You know, and so the relevant analogy is not Clarence Darrow fighting for the underdog, it is Adolf Eichmann and the banality of evil. You know, so anyway, but that's Washington. So.
Perhaps follow up on this and your question, because I'm much less pessimistic. Because what I think this whole story of Azerbaijan has shown us, and this is perhaps not true for every country, perhaps not, it's not true for Turkmenistan, but for Azerbaijan, is first how these PR strategies really don't work if there is any form of mobilization against them. I mean, we've seen it in the last few months. I mean, you know, Azerbaijan was very happy about winning this funny privilege of hosting the Eurovision Song Contest, which is, 40 European countries sending singers to perform rather strange dances and songs, usually in English, in the capital of the country that won the year before. And Azerbaijan wanted to use this to promote itself as this modern, vibrant, dynamic European country. But an NGO coalition, all the big NGOs and a lot of Azerbaijani activists, really managed to hijack that. And the consistent press coverage over the last few months, despite all the money, despite all the lobbying groups,
was extremely critical. Now, of course, there was the occasional story, you know, placed in some media, which described Azerbaijan as this, you know, modern, secular, you know, oil-rich city. But these articles looked almost embarrassing by comparison to all the other coverage. So they actually didn't help either. And I think what that shows us, perhaps, I don't know, perhaps Europeans are less cynical about this kind of lobbying because there are strict rules in most European countries, not everywhere, but in many countries. In Britain, you have to declare every present above a certain value if you're a member of the House of Commons, etc. But perhaps it showed that when these NGOs raised these issues, you know, many of these lobbyists, there's a lobbying organization run by the son of the Minister of Emergency based in London. You know, I heard that in Britain, some of these members of the House of Commons, you know, really were much more careful about speaking out. I know from people in Parliament, you know, suddenly there were less people coming to those meetings. I know that in Strasbourg last week, I've been hearing that the Azerbaijani delegation, people were less happy to hang around with them visibly because probably everybody was suspecting, are they getting their package of caviar? Now, this is not the reform that you need to prevent these things. I think what you need is a constant focus monitoring, which in the end is what democracy or all these institutions are all about. It's this constant monitoring, institutionalized monitoring. And I think what we need to achieve for those countries which, and this is, I think, the caveat, care about their reputation. What is striking is Azerbaijan does care about its reputation. It doesn't want to change its behavior, the regime, but it does care about its reputation. So you have this cynical prisoner carousel. Whenever there's pressure, somebody gets released, other people get arrested. But the response to this can't be to give up, but has to be to institutionalize the monitoring so that more people get released. And indeed, in the last few days again, just before a report in the Council of Europe on political prisoners was supposed to come out, people got released. So I think this is why I'm less skeptical. I don't think you can buy the reputation as easily as people think if enough people mobilize against it.
Okay, I'm not sure I understood this gender-related question. It wasn't gender-related, okay. But my observation is that the organizations that have representatives or offices in Baku, they are much more dependent on government's good attitude than those who don't have representatives. And that shows in their performance. That shows their, because they don't want the government to come and seal their door. They don't want the government to block their events. One example, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE. It's an international organization. Azerbaijan have obligations for before OSCE. So it's Azerbaijan is a member. So it's not an NGO from other countries that comes and asks for interest. It's a membership that has obligations and commitments involved. And that organization, OSCE, organizes an event in October, I think it was October, it was fall 2011, organized an event to discuss issues related to bar associations, to lawyers, defense lawyers. And invitations were sent to independent lawyers, also to include independent lawyers, to lawyers who take human rights cases, who take cases of political prisoners. And then the government said, we don't come if you invite these people. And OSCE didn't find better solution than to call back invitation to independence. So they had this conference without independent lawyers. So this is how the government acts. And it's not the only case. There are like number of cases when government puts a condition as a condition, like you want this project, you have to work with the people we have, like with Gongos basically. So this is and it's very important to confront this policy and to not to let the government of Azerbaijan to get away with that. But unfortunately, organizations, they don't stand for the values they are preaching for.
Hi, my name is Robert Shikona. I don't remember which one of the panelists mentioned the promise of the internet. but we're all familiar with Wikipedia. And as individuals, I think, well, what do you think about the possibility of each of us making an effort to monitor the entries in Wikipedia, which, as we all know, is a major source of information for the general public? I guess that's my question.
Hi, my name is Courtney Brooks. I'm the United Nations correspondent for Radio Free Europe. And this was a question specifically for Ken. I was really interested in what you were saying about the lobbyists essentially writing op-eds and selling them to academics and some second tier, but still, like, I wouldn't consider the Seattle Times a terrible newspaper would print that. And I was wondering if you know more about how that happens, like if the second tier newspaper is printed because second tier academics will agree to do this, or how it is that some newspapers can avoid this huge conflict of interest and some don't.
Malcolm Arnold, I'm a former Russian military intelligence officer with the U.S. Army. The NGOs, as far as not being able to, you know, most people are aware of, let's say, lobbyists. Many people are aware of journalists having stories planted, stuff like that. The role of NGOs being able to either be allowed access into a country and to work into a country and those conditions being put forth by the country where they're operating in, that's something that's pretty well understood. But there was something that was hinted at that transcends that, and that is that NGOs are actually working in cooperation. Intelligence services have done this as far as gathering intelligence. But it was something as far as working with the NGOs as far as for them to get funding, that these countries were providing funding in condition on that these NGOs would talk, would produce propaganda for the host country. And that was hinted at, and I was wondering if somebody could talk about that as far as how NGOs are being used in a propagandistic way for the host countries or to get the agenda across of those host countries.
I have to admit, I don't know how to change anything on Wikipedia, which is embarrassing, but the point is a good one. I know that some of these countries, part of what I said as a throwaway up, you know, putting Facebook things up, but they're also making sure that, you know, that the bio of Aliyev, you know, for example, on Wikipedia says certain things, right? Or the bio, or the Azerbaijan when it comes to the governance section, or not to just pick on Azerbaijan, but all of these. This is another place where these things are being fought out, and this also speaks to, you know, the kind of problems of this kind of open source internet. It can work very well, but, you know, whoever kind of touched it last has a lot of influence. So that to me is a big problem, and a good idea. I don't know where that gentleman is, but the second tier papers issue, from a media angle, I just want to stress that you know, from an academic angle, I mean, I've never been approached to do this, but if somebody said to me, "Hey, Lincoln, you write a lot about democracy issues on Georgia, how's this piece sound?" And let's say it agreed with me, you wouldn't come to me and say, "How's this piece that says Misha is, you know, Thomas Jefferson on the Black Sea?" Because I'm not going to write that piece. But if you said to me, "How does this sound?" What I would say is, let me take a crack at it, and I would put my own spin on it, and then I would say, "You want to help me place it? That's fine." We get evaluated by how many things we publish and where we publish them. So it's the same way lobbying works in general. If you're with the NRA, you don't go to, you know, Jerry Nadler or some kind of left of center congressperson and say, "Hey, support us." You go to the person who's with you and you say, "Make sure you're there for the committee vote," right? You buy access, not opinion, not changing people's views a lot. Second tier papers, by the way, are extremely important. And if you don't believe that, ask President John Kerry, right? Bush, in 2004, put a huge amount of resources into into second-tier media markets. Why is that? Because that's where the swing voters are. And that's where, if you get something in the Cincinnati paper, two congresspeople, right, are going to have to now deal with the fact that so-and-so's a great guy or so-and-so's a bad guy, right? If you put something in the New York Times, which will take your lobbying firm 10 weeks longer to do, yes, you will influence the lead opinion, but you're not influencing the chair of that committee. Right. So if the chair of that committee is from Washington State, Seattle Matters, the Seattle, whatever that paper is called, matters a lot. So this has to do with media strategy. And if you really represent Turkmenistan, give me $500,000, I'll tell you even more. Anybody else wants to take a crack at the question?
Well, in terms of the one question that was asked specifically of me, I know that the placement of op-eds is fairly routine. I, from talking to lobbyists and talking to people at think tanks about this, I think it's safe to say that it is pretty routine. I mean, what you are describing is something a little bit different. I think you would not accept an offer where someone approached you and said, I've drafted this, will you put your name on it? What you're talking about is something slightly different. People at AFCO said that they would, you know, they would draft the op-eds and then go out and find academics or think tank people. Think tanks, I'm actually, the next project I'm working on, which is post-Open Society, is looking at Washington think tanks. And they are completely unregulated. I mean, Washington think tanks live in this, you know, Citizens United world. They've lived that way forever, where there's, you know, unlimited donations, no disclosure. I mean, it's just really pretty scandalous. And even, you know, I'm not just talking about the ideological ones, but across the board, the mainstream think tanks too, the agendas are very much influenced by the donors. And so I think it's a slightly different thing than what you're talking about. The, I mean, I know there are some, it's true. I mean, if you're a lobbyist, you look for people who you know are sympathetic, and then you go out and try to recruit them. There's a part of it that's normal and would be expected, and then there's a part of it that's beyond that. But in addition to this, I mean, I know in the case of Georgia, the Orion Strategies, which is a lobbying firm, which actually has done some work for Open Society, also worked for the government of Georgia. And it is headed by Randy Scheinemann, who was one of the prominent neocons who led the push for the Iraq War. And they flew journalists over to Georgia, paid for their expenses, and completely controlled the agenda, and they got really good coverage out of it. Now, some of it wasn't terribly credible. I mean, in the Weekly Standard, but I guess if it's, you know, if you're a conservative, that is a credible source. But they had a series of pieces. So it's not just op-eds. It's across the board where lobbyists are working with journalists in a variety of ways. And I did just want to quickly say, and then I promise to shut up, when I said previously that politics is dead and that Washington has been captured, I don't mean to say that politics is meaningless. And I agree that politics is important. I mean, it's what I've been doing for the last 30 years. Oh, sorry about that. And but I do think that money has just captured the culture, the political culture of Washington in a way that's really alarming and new and terribly scary. But when you talk about how, well, lobbyists can only do so much, I agree, it's true. You cannot take a, like, Turkmenistan, you're just not going to turn the country's image around. But the one thing that you can do is to use these countries. I mean, the lobbyists are ripping off the countries because they're promising that they can do more than they can actually do. But just as Hillary Clinton went to Azerbaijan and met with a group of non-representative NGOs, I think the influence of oil on foreign policy, it's not to say, I mean, it's not just oil. It's more complicated than that. It's oil and national security and all sorts of other issues, regional politics. But these countries can leverage those factors in a way that is unfortunate. And, you know, there are victories that are won all the time, and those are important. So I don't mean to say that politics is meaningless, just that it's depressing. I mean, Washington, I mean, I've lived in Washington too long, I guess.
Well, let me add a couple words. Actually, I used to live in Washington for like a year and a half when I used to work for Voice of America, and I subscribed to several listservs of Azerbaijani diaspora in the U.S. And we would receive sometimes letters saying, like, describing it. It would be May 10th congressional moments when Congress members would remind that it's birthday of the late national leader of Azerbaijan, Heydar Aliyev, and how great personality he was. I wonder, like, how big lobby efforts it costed to Azerbaijani government to have this congressmen, members of Congress, to just to speak, like, out of blue about the birthday of Heydar Aliyev. But it lasted for a couple years, and after the flow of criticism on, come on, let's let's channel lobbying efforts for something better. It stopped. Well, I'm not sure it's being channeled much more effectively now. I just know that there are much more money being spent on these efforts, and it's yet to be examined, the transparency issue. As far as the intelligence question came, I'm not an intelligence person, so I know very little about intelligence. But I read the letter Warren Mitofsky, the former... the late public poll expert wrote about exit polls. He wrote that exit polls were used by the governments to expose falsifications in elections and then use that information against the other governments. And it would, on the other hand, it would be used by the host country to justify, like, to show that elections were not. So whoever is paying for exit poll always have something in mind in order to, like to use that information further. So we had exit poll that was paid by USAID back in 2005. I was covering elections and we've been waiting for exit poll results vigorously. But by the way, Warren Mitofsky was one of the exit pollers that year. We had several exit polls. One was conducted by USAID, one by so-called Renaissance Group, which later we've learned that it's actually based in Baku, the company, and it first it was presented as an international organization. Then well, Warren Mitofsky, and then there were some Estonian guys. So we had three exit polls at the moment. Warren Mitofsky later described how he was basically the guys who paid forced him to fix some things, which he didn't do. But anyways, they didn't publish some of the information. You can find his letter in internet. But... what comes to USAID? $1 million has been spent on that exit poll. It's US taxpayers' money. And what happened later? Till midnight, the PA Consulting, that was the company's name, they would release results. And they released results on several districts. All the results they released were different from the government results, Central Election Commission results. At midnight, they stopped releasing results. In the morning, they released the rest of the results, and all of them were similar to the government's. My friend who used to work in that organization, 2 years after this, actually 3 years after 2005 elections, she said that there was a phone call from ambassador that stopped releasing information. Well, but there is a reason for paying $1 million for this adventure. So I guess the information was used for something else, and US governments managed to use that information to get something else from the Azerbaijani government. Well, in that case, I am as Azerbaijani citizen, feel like someone abused my trust, and you as the U.S. resident probably should ask what you gained for $1 million taxpayers' money. Well, we are yet to know. Maybe history will open that. But I know that there were gross falsification of elections, and there were lots of evidence confirming that, and the European Court of Human Rights is now making decisions on different cases of 2005 parliamentary elections, and in all the cases that reached European Court of Human Rights, there were decisions showing that there were falsifications and violations in the elections. So it was confirmed by the court. Well, U.S. government helped Azerbaijani government to cover it. So that's what we have here.
So let's take the last round of questions. We have about 10 more minutes. So if you have a question.
My name is, excuse me, Tanya Milich, and I work in American domestic politics and have for 40 years. And I am a child of the Cold War. And what astounds me is that most of it, what you're all talking about up there has been going on for a very long time. We also had a Gilded Age. What I think is different is that the countries you're talking about are in the middle of one of the hot spots of the world right now. And I would like to have, and I agree with the comments made about the Council of Europe, that it's this new technological age that is allowing things positively to happen. And I would like you to think of this theoretically and try to, rather than talk about a specific incident, try to look at the questions of energy, military, security in the context of what these various governments have to do, and also in the, excuse me, in the context of what the title of this panel was supposed to be about.
My name is Sarah Paulsworth. I'm a law student studying in the United States, but I lived in Azerbaijan for 6 years. My question is somewhat specific and maybe just for Hatice, but I know they just passed a law and it will protect a lot of information related to commercial entities. And I wanted to hear more about this law. First of all, is it fully passed and when will it be enacted? And how will that affect your work and all of the transparency initiatives that the government claims to be a part of? Thank you.
I'm Wendy Lewis, the Foundation for a Civil Society. I'd like to follow on what Gerald said about the fact that there was a pushback that was somewhat effective in answering you the questions. I mean, we all in the human rights world know Michael Posner. He's part of the State Department. He would have been one of the people, his Department of Human Rights and Democracy and Rule of Law would have been preparing Hillary's trip. NDI is funded by the Congress of the United States. I'm asking where the pushback, where effective pushback can be utilized. I'm old enough that the nature of the beast argument, what goes around comes around. I think there is a way of pushing back, but I'm not sure that we are all being very effective in that way. And I'd like to ask you specifically, how much preparatory to her trip were you able to get into, and was it an internal argument within the government that made the decision that she would cave as far as that meeting you were concerned, or whatever else?
Well, regarding Hillary Clinton's visit, well, nobody asked our opinion about whom it's better to meet, sometimes when U.S. officials come to Azerbaijan, well, in many cases they would be guests of Radio Liberty, which I work for. This is not the case for past 2 years, past year and a half. So we interview them sometimes when specifically the human rights people come. I think one of the hotspots between the U.S. government and the Azerbaijani government is the restoration of the broadcast of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. For you to know, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty is banned on local frequencies in Azerbaijan. So it's along with Voice of America and BBC. So it's we don't air our programs on FM, AM. We broadcast through internet and satellite. So, but what we do is still relevant because this is the sole source of independent information, independent professional journalism in Azerbaijan. And it's very important. Well, I'm one of those who believe that it's important to work inside the country and outside the country. But inside the country, it's important to have a TV station there is no single TV channel in the country that tells the truth to people. There is no single TV channel. So that's one of the very important issues that needs to be done in the inside the country for Azerbaijanis. There is an utmost importance to start the TV channel, maybe beaming from outside, but telling the truth. That is not controlled by the government, because all of the channels either owned or controlled by the president, his family, and family members. For example, two of my colleagues who's been blackmailed by sex tapes, their sex video, was shown on primetime news on the TV channel ran by president's cousin. And it was 7 o'clock primetime news, kids were not in bed yet, no genitals, no faces has been covered. So this is how they use the TV, the information resources they have against the critical journalists. So it's important to have a TV station for Azerbaijanis. This is for inside the country, because they need to know the truth. That's one thing. In Washington or outside the world, it's important to pass the message. It's important to tell that it's an internet age. You cannot actually get away with covering the truth with like this old style diplomacy of, because things are being spoken. These things are being distributed via internet. So you cannot basically, the world is too small. There are no boundaries anymore. And corruption and wars are good when they are outside of your borders. There are no borders anymore. The world is too small now. So you have to take into account that fact. And it's important to educate. I mean, you educate U.S. government about, well, WikiLeaks showed that they don't lack information. We thought that they lack information. There is no lack of information. WikiLeaks exposed that officers in the ground, they would update governments. Well, governments took decisions because they have other interests. Azerbaijan provides airspace for flights to Afghanistan, and it has to be taken into account. So this is one thing. To the question of regarding the information law. Yeah, I forgot to tell that, like, while speaking to civil society leaders and then civil society organizations, anti-corruption civil society organizations, Hillary Clinton actually some NGOs asked the guys in the meeting to pass her a letter about this information law. And the new law says that all information about ownership of commercial entities is now a secret. Now Azerbaijan is a haven for organized crime, because you can secretly open the company and nobody except the government will know that about it. So media will not be able to investigate these issues. So this is the message the government of Azerbaijan is giving to the world. The parliament has passed the law, but it is yet to be signed by the government, by the president of Azerbaijan. And since the draft law came from President Aliyev, we don't think it's going to be a problem for him to sign. So our time is out. But
Gerald, to make a few comments, and I was going to make a closing.
No, just a really short comment, because I think I certainly, you know, this is private diplomacy part one, how Azerbaijan silenced the Council of Europe. Part two is supposed to be what can be done about it. Which will come out in the next 2 weeks. I think, you know, there's no reason to be defeatist, certainly in what we've been looking at. The key is to identify really what the red lines are, and I completely agree with you. You know, it's very important to distinguish between legitimate lobbying. You know, when you know, ESI, we are a think tank. You know, we believe Turkey should get visa-free travel. We don't get money from the Turkish government.
We do go to the Swedish government, which we know agrees with us. We say, can you support us? That's legitimate. You know, that's what everybody does. The line is crossed when either you represent positions which really you ought to be discredited for by others. You know, that's the peer pressure. Or you are an institution with a mandate which you are openly breaking. You know, if election observers see in front of their eyes something that is written down by long-term observers, deny it, then go to an assembly. Before that, they've been receiving, you know, benefits. You know, I think that's different. And I think this is where we need to identify where the red lines are. But what we found, which is encouraging, is that when NGOs identify this, you know, people are embarrassed. They do not like this to be exposed. And I think part of the story that we see is just the normal pushback. You know, so perhaps we were over-optimistic 10 years ago. All these institutions accepted countries. It even worked for a few years. But then the countries became smarter. They fought back. And the good people basically weren't paying attention. You know, members of the assembly who do care about human rights didn't care enough. And this is, I think, where NGOs can do quite a lot if they are motivated. And certainly OSI has done a lot in Azerbaijan. Supporting some of these local NGOs to get their message out to Europe, it really worked.
Let me just end with a couple of comments. I think the West has a little bit backed themselves into a corner on this, and I think it's important also to disaggregate the kind of influence buying and changing the standard side of it with the foreign policy side of it. One explanation for the behavior of the U.S. government with regards to Azerbaijan is that the U.S. government doesn't care about democracy in Azerbaijan. I mean, that seems to me to be the obvious explanation. And if you start from there, everything makes sense, right? And I believe that is the position. Hillary Clinton knows about all these things, but she wants the oil, she wants the cooperation on security issues, and that's going to trump all of this, and that's the way the ballgame works. And the job of people like us is to change that, but it's never going to be easy. But And the lobbying is part of that, but it's not all of that. They're pushing an open door, right? The problem, the way we backed ourselves into a corner is that we've raised democracy to something that we really say publicly all the time matters. And if we say it matters all the time publicly, then we either have to come frankly out and say we're hypocrites, which we are, or we have to create some narrative that the country is more democratic, right? So we define democracy in weird ways, right? Democracy, we all know, I mean, I teach a course on... I used to teach a course on democracy and democracy building at Columbia, and we spent one of our seminars discussing definitions of democracy. But we all know in Washington what a Democrat is. A Democrat is somebody who's from another country, is under 50 years old, and speaks English, right? That, if anybody who's worked in Washington knows, that's the definition of a Democrat. And if that's your working definition of a Democrat, then it's very easy to look at Azerbaijan, I don't know about Turkmenistan, sorry, but certainly at Georgia. And to overlook things because it's much easier than just saying, you know what, we have other priorities there, because we've taken that option off the table for us as a policy approach. Thank you for coming. This was a great discussion. Thank you to OSI for organizing it.